session number 21877, Reel 1.
Kramer, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Portsmouth.
Which year was this?
1915.
Can you tell me a bit about your family background? Did you, both your parents come from Portsmouth?
My father came from Newcastle-on-Tyne. My mother was born in Portsmouth. We lived with my grandparents. My dear old grandfather, he came from Southern Ireland in Cork. He was a policeman in the Metropolitan Police, stationed in Portsmouth. And my gran came from Norwich.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a gun mounting fitter in the dockyard.
Where did you go to school in Portsmouth?
In Alfred Road, St John's Cathedral School, Alfred Road, Portsea. After that, I got a scholarship at St John's College, South Sea. And from there, I went to employment as a police clerk at Portsmouth City Police just before my 18th birthday when I joined.
What was life like in Portsmouth pre-war?
What was?
Life like in Portsmouth
pre-war. Well, it's a very busy, bustling city in those days. You know, over a quarter of a million population then. Life was quite fun for teenagers.
Was it a peaceful city, or was there ever any trouble?
Right in the Portsea area, which was near the dockyard, a policeman had to double up from about 10 o'clock because of Jolly Jack Tar and his lady friends. But generally, there's not the violence in clubs and so forth because there weren't clubs and teenagers never used to go to pubs in those days.
Did you join any services like TA before the war?
No, you couldn't. You weren't allowed to as a potential policeman.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
When he came back from Germany?
No, when he actually declared
war on
Germany.
Oh, yes, yes. I joined the force proper in 1935. And in 1939, I was in the Chief Constable's office, and we were all around the radio when we heard the actual words, you know, we are at war with Germany.
How did you feel about that?
Mixed feelings, because for many months, year or so, the police had been preparing for the take part in organising air raid precautions in the city. And as we're the premier naval port in the world at that time, we expected Portsmouth would be a number one target. So of course, we had a larger organisation in Portsmouth than possibly Southampton at the time. So we're keyed up as far as home defence is concerned.
How did the war affect you at first?
12 hours on and 12 hours off duty. And it was round about that time, the outbreak of war, that I became a little bit restless about participating in the war, because I didn't really want to stay at home in the police. And I was always army mad, always reading about what went on in the First World War and so forth. Which is surprising, really, because there's no military history in the Kramer family. None of my ancestors, I don't think, were in any military occupation. But I was mad to get into it.
So when did you volunteer to join?
Well, I volunteered about a day or so after the 3rd of September 39 and put a report in asking whether I could be permitted to resign in order to join the forces. Because part of my job at that time was looking after the watch committee minutes. And a few months before the outbreak of war, there's the Police and Firemen's War Service Act, which said that any member of the force who volunteered to join the HM forces would be allowed to do so with the permission of their chief officer, and their pay would be made up less 15 shillings subsistence. But the chief turned my application down. I put another application in about two or three weeks after that. That was turned down. But at the beginning of November, I went into the recruiting office and made inquiries about what regiments were available. And there were you couldn't volunteer at the beginning of November because all the army depots were chock-a-block with reservists and so forth. And they said they would send me a postcard when recruiting was open. So on the morning of the 17th of November, I got the postcard to the effect that recruiting had opened for infantry. And I went down during my dinner hour and asked what regiments were available. They said the Royal Artillery and the Brigade of Guards. So I asked which regiments were in the Brigade of Guards and which was the Southerly Regiment. He said, well, Grenadiers, possibly. So I said I was interested in joining the Grenadiers. So they said, would you like to give us all your particulars? I said, well, I was supposed to clear my chief first, but yes, we'd do it. So I filled in the application form. A medical officer happened to be on the premises at the recruiting office, and he passed me fit. And then I was sworn in as a member of the regular army, 4 years with the colours and 8 with the reserve. They gave me travel papers to Chelsea Barracks, the Guard Depot Wing, London. And my first day's pay, two shillings a day it was. And then I went back to the chief office and typed in another application to be allowed to join the army, to retire, resign from the police. And the chief, I suppose, a bit fed up, and he said, yes. So away I went, got myself dressed up, with collar and tie and everything. And with my railway warrant, I got to Chelsea Barracks. And I went through the door, and there's a steel helmeted sentry there. So I said, excuse me, could you tell me to whom I'll report? He never answered. So I repeated it, and he nodded towards the guard room. And then there was a terrific noise. Here, you! So I looked round, and there was a Scots guard with a dice band and a brass peak glaring at me. And even though I swear he's about 7 feet tall, he said, who the bloody hell are you? I said, I've come to join up, Sergeant. Come here. So I walked towards him, run, or double. So I doubled to him. He stand up straight. No, what about it? I showed him my join up papers. And he said, ah, bloody policeman, eh? I said, yeah. He said, my Christ, we sort you out. He sent for an orderly, and we doubled to the recruits reception squad. And put me in front of a trained soldier. He showed me all the ropes. Showed me how to make my bed. Three biscuits on an iron bedstead. And it took me to the quartermaster where I got a plate and knife, fork and spoon. And then went away to the clothing stores where they fitted me out with all the necessary, including, to my surprise, a suit of best dress uniform, which is the jacket that was issued before the war, long tubular trousers, long puttees, boots and everything, because they had the old best dress uniform, the old khaki uniform which was issued to troops in the First World War, the cap, comforter and all the necessary. And then there were four or five other recruits in there, in the reception squad. And we were marched to the dining hall. And all this dreadful muck, I thought, was laid out to us. We were sent to a little part of the dining hall they would serve for their recruits. I couldn't eat my dinner because I was a very fastidious eater, completely spoiled. Didn't like the skin off rice pudding and things like that. I didn't eat anything for about 2 or 3 days afterwards. I used to eke out my few shillings I got on what they call chars and wads. And after about 5 or 6 days, I realised this wouldn't work. And I ate more and more. And the army completely converted me. I could eat anything now, whether it's burnt or crisp or anything. It did the world good because, you know, I thought I was, you know, part of the Lord's anointed. Oh, when I left the recruiting office, the recruiting sergeant, and if I could get hold of him, I would kill him, said, "My God, the guards would be pleased to see a well set up young man like you. You know, they cut me right down the sides." But, the training was terrific. Very good training. Eventually, we were squadded. A squad of about 24 men, I think. We had our own drill instructor. And from then on, I was a fully fledged recruit guardsman.
Can you give any details of the guards' training methods as you experienced them?
Well, everything you did was done by numbers. You were taught how to use a shovel by numbers. And it's 1, 2, 3, 1. 2, 3, 1. Everything was come. And the usual army method was, now this morning, I'm going to teach you to light machine gun. And they relay all the things, the muzzle velocity and everything. First of all, on the command one, you throw yourself down behind the gun, and you, with your left hand, you get all this right hand. Now, to make it easier for you, I'll break it up in the movements and all this business. But the foot drill is wonderful, the foot drill. And you really got part of the squad. You got squad-minded. And it's like a real family. You're ever so friendly with all the members. Now, which brings me to the present day where there's bullying, something goes on. Now, I'd never saw any bullying in the guards. The guards instructors called you all the names under the sun. You know, F this and F that. But that you never saw them striking or thumping anybody. It's apparently happened sometimes nowadays. And you never saw the men ganging up on, you know, the weaker members of the squad. It was a really enlightening period I went through there. Mind you, if you did wrong, you know, with using your toothbrush to do the barrack steps and things like that, if you the kit inspection were out of this world, you had to polish the hobnails on your boots, and blacken your soles, and you were taught how to do little, you know, spit and polish your boots, how to burn your badges, cap badges.
Burn?
You used to burn them. You used to have the lid of a kiwi tin. You used to put a little drop of petrol in it, and sometimes, no, not petrol, the brass polishing thing.
Brasso.
That was poured in, and then you put the badge in, and then you lit it with a match. And you didn't let it burn too much, otherwise you would have melted the solder, which attaches the, you know, the little eyelet holes of the badge. And then you polished it. You burnt your boots as well. You know, you ran plenty of boot polish into the boot, and then you heated a spoon, and to get rid of all the pimples in the leather, so they're absolutely glossy, like mirrors, like looking glasses. But of course, I didn't do the boots much good, because I found the difference when I joined other regiments later, because that weaken the sewing. You see the thread keep on burning them. You never had any dubbin boots or anything. And as I thought, after a time, the boots started to crack. All the oil had gone out of the leather, you see. But as I say, a kit inspection, you had to whitewash the cord if you pull through, and all these silly little things. But we used to laugh about them. Punishment was fierce. If you had, you know, when you sometimes you were standing with your with the shoulder arms and so forth, you would slope arm, and they would inspect your fingernails. If your fingernails got dirty, you were put on what's on active service, dirty on parade, things like that. And the punishment was the dreaded pack drill, where you dressed up in marching order, everything blankoed, boots polished and so forth, and you were belted round the square by a drill instructor, at the double sometimes, with a rifle.
Did you get that? I never got back drill.
The trained soldier who's in charge of our barrack room, they were sometimes receive pack drill if they had a dirty barrack room, which we were supposed to clean. We used to get pack drill, and we used to watch a trained soldier being drilled. And when a bloke's properly drilled, it has a thing of beauty to see the turns, the little kick turns and things they used to do. But anybody seen watching him, they got punished as well, and recruits, and the following day, they were on pack drill as well. But the officers, I wasn't impressed, they're very effete types. They had kind of pantaloon trousers with their carefully wound up putties and brown boots. But I didn't like them much. The guards, as nearly all infantry regiment, they're run by the sergeants and the sergeant majors, especially in action. You see, well, I've never had much time for duty officers. They had less service of the newly joined recruits sometimes. They had to be nursed by the sergeants. But the sergeants were the backbone of the army. And of course the sergeant majors controlled the sergeants, so they were important as well. But the regimental history lectures were good. And as a result, you had a fierce pride in your regiment and a contempt for other regiments in the brigade. You know, the Coldstream. And the Coldstream hate the Grenadiers. Because the Coldstream had formed before the Grenadiers. And as they fought against King Charles, 1652, I think they were formed. But as they fought against the king, they weren't allowed to. When the Civil War was over and the Coldstream Guards came down to Tower Hill, they were ordered to ground their arms and then pick out their arms to be a King's Regiment. I think they were made 1660, that one. And as we were 1656, we were the first all Grenadier Regiment of Foot Guards. And of course, the Grenadiers, Nulli Secundus, that's a regiment, second to none. They always march at the rear. They're always on the left of the line. All things like that, you see. Lies and exaggerations. And that's how they build up regimental pride. But it is terrific regimental pride, though. Came the time I passed out. Oh, another thing, which is rather important. After about 3 or 4 weeks in the Guards, I wrote to the chief constable and asked for my pay to be made up. Never got an answer. So about 3 or 4 weeks later, I wrote again. And about a fortnight after that, I got a letter from the town clerk. I still got the letter upstairs. Said the chief constable informs us that you left the force without permission, and therefore you are not entitled to have your pay made up. But a friend of mine sent a general order where the resignation of PC 97 Kramer was accepted, He will be entitled to return to the force after the cessation of hostilities, and his superannuation deductions will not be returned to him. Will stay with the force. In other words, I'm still a member of the force, but as he said, he hadn't given permission, I never got my pay made up. Because I was getting 2 shillings a day, that's 14 shillings a week. They took half of that because I was married, so that's 7 shillings a week. And they put 2 shillings off me to build up my credits, you know, when you go on leave or barrack damages and things. So I was left for 5 shillings a week. But of course, in those days, with beer about 4 and 5 pence a pint, and a cinema ticket in London was about 1 and 6, it wasn't too bad, really. And you had all your food and everything in, so it wasn't too bad. So I then, about January, February, I went through to the training battalion of the Grenadiers at Victoria Batch Windsor. And from then on, the training slacked off a bit, but it's still intense. And then you did the Newcastle, Windsor Castle night guards. And that was a bit of a thrill because you march through the streets in the evening, accompanied by the drum and fife. That was lovely, that was. And of course, you had great pleasure in marching, you know, smartly. A squad used to march, or a guard used to march as one man. You know, there wasn't an inch out anywhere. Wonderful. And you feel so, you know, you're really part of a unit with a drum and fife, marching up the hill, the Windsor Barracks, night guard. And then, about May, I think, the battle in France started. You know, the Germans went too bad in France. And I was getting a bit restless again. And then I was nominated, which is wrong, really, to go to Sandhurst. Because looking back now, it's ridiculous. I'd had about three or four months army service. I didn't know hardly anything about map reading. Never taken a squad on the square or anything. And they sent me to OCTU, Officer Cadet Training Unit, the Sandhurst. And I was there for about 6 or 7 weeks. But it was utterly beyond me because when a map was thrown at me and said, make your way from map reference so and so to map reference so and so, I was at a loss. And as I said, I had a bit of a loss of confidence. And then I was told I didn't have leadership quality. I was hopeless to take squads on the square. Of course, I'd only just recently learned how to march myself, let alone instruct other people. And at Sandhurst, of course, I was with sergeant majors, full sergeants, and a lot of university trained people and public school people who'd had the benefit of officer training corps, you know, where they'd taken squads on the square and everything. And I wasn't happy at all. And they said, well, you haven't got the leadership quality necessarily at the moment. And would you like to go back to your battalion? So my wife, meantime, had been evacuated up to Newcastle because my father had got a very good job as an Admiralty inspector at the Alsick at Vickers Armstrong Works in Newcastle, where he'd actually received his apprenticeship training. And he's living out there with my gran and my wife and my little baby son. So I said, could I go to Northumberland Fusiliers? Right. So after about another fortnight, I was on my way up to Fenham Barracks, to the depot. Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, the old and bold, the fighting fifth. It was a bit awkward, because there I was with my Grenadier Guards labels on my shoulders, and a you know, I set up Grenadier Cap, walking through, you know, saying, this is, you know, recruit Kramer again. They gave me a 4.5 cup, you know, that one out there. And for about a week, I was treated as a normal recruit. And it became a bit embarrassing because the recruit squad I was in was about 2 weeks old, I suppose. And they'd just come on to arms drill. And there was a young sergeant and a corporal teaching me how to do, you know, slope arms and present arms and all that. And of course, you know, the show-off as I am, they said, right, we will now do the slope arm from the order. Watch me and I'll give you a complete demonstration. Bang, bang, bang. And to make it easier for you, we break it up into movements. You know, you count your rifle smartly up and catch it and all this and the other. And of course, I swanked, you see, up. Crash, you know, when the rifle went on his shoulder, crash, retort them, you know, noisy arm drill it was. Sometimes the guards used to loosen the screws on the butt plate to make more of a jangle. They used to have coins in the magazine so that when it bang, a terrific row, it's all noise and a stamping of feet and everything. Of course, when I used to say left turn, right turn, crash. You would hear at the other end, and when you got the paper, you know, the fusiliere Kramer, and you're up going, crash, you know, and it used to be in the gym and the dust used to fly. After about a week, the sergeant in charge of the squad asked me the RSM, this bloke's taking a piss all the time, sir. So they took me on drill, and for the rest of my recruit training, I was pushed through the medium machine gun, the dear old Vickers. Wonderful gun. And I became a machine gun instructor. And then I was made a Lance Corporal, local acting unpaid, LAUP, local acting unpaid Lance Corporal in the depot. And then I was posted to a newly reformed 7th Battalion Royal Northumberland Fusiliers up at I've got the name there, Aberlady, that's right, on the 1st of 4th.
Could you, before you go on to Aberlady, could you tell me about the handling of the Vickers machine gun as you learnt it?
Oh, that was a wonderful gun. It's so complex. Because you were issued with slide rules, you did overhead supporting fire and flanking supporting fire. You had to be very careful and make sure that your tripod legs were securely anchored, otherwise you'd decimate the troops you were supposed to be supporting. But you had angles of sight and with the indirect fire, you can fire at night because you had a little sighter, you had clinometers. It's very scientific. It's like a big gun, really, because you could hit, you had the new streamlined ammunition, Z ammunition, 303Z ammunition, which went, God, about 4,000 yards, I think it went. You could support troops the other side of a hill, because you do a map shoot. It's very involved, and because it was sort of just before the First World War it came into being, didn't it? The Vickers machine gun, medium machine gun, and as we used it in the Second World War as well. Devastating, it was, burst of 25, wonderful gun. So I had a real grounding on that. Then I went out to Aberlady. Now a little thing in history. When the Germans invaded France, there was the 51st Highland Division in front of them, and the 51st Highland Division retired before the, you know, overwhelming forces, and they ended up at St. Valery, the division. and where it was, you know, captured, the 51st Highlanders wiped out, but you know, to prisoner. But quite a few people escaped, and in it was the machine gun battalion and the 7th, a territorial battalion, Northumberland Fusiliers with them. Well, about 7 or 8 officers and about 15 other ranks got away. They kept them together, took them back to Newcastle, sent them to Aberlady, and then they called up about 600 men from South Staffordshire, most of them miners, they conscripted,